Support for WKAR is provided by Astera Credit Union, a proud supporter of Current State's Neighbors in Action segment. Newest location is now open on West Saginaw Highway on Lansing's west side. Information at asteracu.com. And by MSU Alumni Association, offering opportunities for networking, career services, and community involvement with MSU alumni in your area and across the country. alumni.msu.edu.
Welcome to Current State on WKAR. I'm Scott Westerman, sitting in for Mark Bayshore, who is sunning in Cancun this week. And behind the glass, Joe Lindstroth is producing. Andy Curtis is running the controls. And that's Aaron Young you see tweeting at KAR Current State on Twitter. Coming up on today's show, we'll hear how one of the state's most notorious unsolved murders altered Lansing's politics forever. Plus, we feature volunteers who support Lansing firefighters in our Neighbors in Action segment. And we'll have Scott Pohl's interview with opera diva Renee Fleming, who's performing tonight at the Wharton Center. But first, if you're within the sound of my voice, the name Susie Merchant is probably as familiar as a family member. She's in her sixth season as head coach of the women's basketball team here at Michigan State, balancing the pressures of a Big Ten program with the adventures surrounding parenting of two boys. Welcome to the program, Susie.
Thanks for having me, Scott. I really appreciate it.
You know, when I was looking out the window this morning, I was imagining that scene in The Christmas Story where the mom bundles Ralphie's little brother up in so many layers he can barely move. What's a typical winter morning like at the Merchant Reconnect?
Well, today it was quite a fight over a coat my two-year-old did not want to wear. I don't know why all of a sudden the winter coat that he's worn every single day is not appropriate anymore, and he was trying to get into another one. So I'd like to say it was a warm and fuzzy morning, but it never is. And I was trying to pack myself because I'm on a trip later today recruiting and then to we'll replay at Purdue tomorrow. So between get myself together, my two boys, and my husband's out of town, it was an adventure all before about 7:45 a.m.
Wow. My wife, Colleen, wanted me to ask you, what's the breakfast fare at your household?
It's called a little Cliff Bar, a Z Bar. So tell her that there's not a lot of breakfast happening. And usually a stop at Quality Dairy for my caffeine and maybe a donut for the boys.
She wants me to send you her oatmeal bake recipe. Coaching Division One basketball is a pressure cooker. How do you keep pace and maintain some semblance of a life outside of the game?
It's hard. I mean, I think that's the one thing I will tell you that has been a challenge for me, especially early when I first got here. I mean, I had been a Division One head coach and actually a head coach since I've been 25, so I understood that. But this level is just a different kind of feel. It's a bigger stage, obviously, a national stage, but the recruiting, the outside demands of the job, I mean, that was a little bit more than I understood coming into the position. And I had just given birth to my first child when I got the job here. So I remember one day after about 7-8 months on the job, and so we're about halfway through our season, I would go in Ty's room when he was only about 6 months old, and I'd, you know, cradle him, and I would feel guilty. You know, I'd feel guilty as a mom because I wasn't there all the time for him. And then when I was at work, I felt guilty. And then when I was at home, I felt guilty about, you know, maybe not making more recruiting calls or watching more film. And so I had one of those aha moments, as they say, where you just say enough's enough, and I just have to change what I'm doing and not beat myself up so much, and really just try to compartmentalize both situations. And you know, when I'm a mom, I'm gonna be a mom, put that phone down, focus on my boys. And when I have to be a coach, I'll be a coach. And if there's a time where I can merge them both, so be it. But in the meantime, I think the best thing I can do is just be 100% in the moment.
That's a common challenge, I think, for more and more working moms in Michigan now, isn't it?
It is. And there's not many women in my profession that have a family. And if they do, a lot of times their husbands don't work. And my husband has his own career. He has his own company. So he's a busy guy. So we really rely on a village of people from, you know, my folks early on lived here with us and helped us to now we have a great babysitter / nanny, a Michigan State graduate student. So, you know, all in the family, we're all Spartans.
Everyone asks you about the basketball season. I want to talk about the stories that don't make the front page in the State Journal. Madison Williams, highly touted recruit, high expectations, and a series of injuries that would make a lesser athlete give it up. She hasn't missed a game this season.
Yeah, Madison Williams, boy, your heart just on one level breaks for her. On the other side, just fills up with a lot of inspiration and joy. You know, she is a tremendous human being, Scott. Above all, she's got high character, a very strong in her faith person, too. So I think she relies a lot on some of the adversity she's had. She just sort of, you know, prays about it and gives it up and, you know, believes that there's a higher calling and another purpose for maybe why this has happened to her. But she's an inspiring person. And one of my favorite stories about her is after she's blown her ACL, her knee, basically three times. And as you mentioned, she's a 6'7 McDonald's All-American, could dunk. I mean, is a game-changing program changer in our game. You know, after this third one, after she got over the shock and the disappointment, she came in my office a couple of days later and she said, you know, Coach, every year that we do the Hall of Fame and they hand out the varsity jackets, you know, at Wharton Center there, she said, I never want you to give me one. I'm going to earn one. I'm going to get on that court. I'm going to play. I'm going to get through a Big Ten season. When I walk across that stage and get my varsity coat, it'll be because I earned it, not because somebody gave it to me because they felt bad for me. So that's after her third ACL, her third major injury that's kept her out of playing. And if you think about it, next year, she should be a senior, you know, and she's still willing to come back and give it one more try and has actually had another surgery on her other knee to try to, you know, clean some things up. So she's had it, you know, she's had as tough as anybody. And, you know, I pray and I hope that she has a chance. I mean, just one, give her 1 year, maybe two, where she can, you know, feel good about her experience on the basketball court because she loves Michigan State, loves this place. So,
well, she's actively involved in the game. I see her cheering the loudest on the bench.
Yeah, sometimes I have to, like, get her out of the way so I can call a play. She's jumping up so much. And, you know, she just loves everybody here. And everyone's been so wonderful here from, you know, Dr. Simon and Mark Hollis, obviously, Izzo and D'Antonio. I mean, there's so much support and love here that I think she feels inspired to come back and prove to people that, you know, she's worthy of a scholarship.
Chemistry here among the coaches seems to me to be something really special.
It is. I mean, it's so different. I mean, I heard Izzo say once, it's like a bunch of Division II coaches as people in a big-time BCS level. And what that means is, you know, when you're a Division II coach, because I've been one before, I mean, I was the head coach, the compliance coordinator, the academic advisor, and the senior women's administrator. So wore many hats. So in order to do that, you know, the men's basketball coach was the facility guy, and the golf coach handled, you know, certain different things. So what it does is force people to really connect and communicate, and, you know, we all wear different hats. So it's important to give to each other, and I think he's right about that. You know, I expected it to be a little more business-like, but I mean, I'll get phone messages and text messages from Mark D'Antonio, and he'll stop over. And obviously, I work with Izzo pretty closely on a day-to-day basis, and Coach Anastas and Kathy George and Jackie and Jake. I mean, there's just so many of them to really, you know, it just is special. It's special. And I think our recruits feel that. I really do. I think on the women's side, for us, maybe we're not selling the pro game as much as the men's side and how we can get them millions of dollars at the next level, because that's not really where we're at with our game. But it's about a feeling, and how do they feel when they come to Michigan State? And when you have those kind of people you can put in front of them, it's pretty special.
How do you get a group of elite athletes to think about what happens after they finish playing?
Well, that's a tricky thing sometimes. I think, you know, for me, I actually try to get them to focus in on the moment, you know, and just how special it is to be here and what it means to be a Spartan and to appreciate the person to their right and to their left. And, you know, you won't remember sometimes all of the wins and the plays and whatnot, but you'll remember the feeling that you have playing with and fighting for and alongside your teammates, and the bond that you'll have will be forever. And I just think an athlete, it's a different kind of bond, and not to say anything's different or, you know, about students that are in programs, but, you know, when you are blood, sweat, and tears with the person, you know, to your right and to your left, it's just a different connection for the rest of your life. And so I always really try to get them not to play with each other, but to play for each other.
A transferable skill into the real world.
Absolutely. I mean, if you're more worried about being a good teammate than you are being the person, I think your team ends up having a lot more success. And I think this year's been probably the best example of that for us.
How often do you hear from your alumni?
oh my gosh, I talk to them all the time. And it's so great with social media now. I mean, on Twitter and certainly on Facebook and all the things that you can do. It's so nice to stay up with LaKendra, Porsche, Taylor. All three of those guys are playing pro. Cal comes back and forth. Satara's, you know, right as a graduate assistant for me and stayed on with me. So, you know, there's many of them. I talk to Alyssa DeHaan quite a bit. Aisha Jefferson, I mean, you could just go Lauren H. Oh my gosh, there's probably a better example and a more impressive person out of our organization than Lauren H.
Now, one of my favorite stories that you tell is what I've come to call the Susie Merchant test, something that has little to do with athleticism, but everything to do with character. Tell us that story.
Yeah, well, I figured this out a long time ago when I was a head coach and I was 25 years old. I always felt like I could figure out who was the most talented, but I really wanted a good team. So for us, we really, really focused on bringing good kids in. Now, how do you do that? So, you know, the NCAA has so many limits that we can go watch kids play. So one of the times I would save, my fifth and final time, I already knew they could, you know, they were the kid for our program in terms of athleticism. But I would go when they didn't know I was coming. I would never tell them, the AD, the principal, nobody knew. And I wouldn't wear any gear. And I'd sneak into the game and I would watch them. And I just watched how they interacted with their teammates and their coaches and the officials. And I hopefully picked a game where I knew they weren't going to play a lot. Actually, they were going to blow the team out. So I could see, do they cheer for their teammates when it's not about them? And I just think that's been a good recipe for me. Honestly, Scott, I think it's, you know, really allowed me to see truly someone's colors when they don't know you're there.
Anybody ever blow it?
Absolutely. I had a kid blow it, and she came out of the locker room. They had won a big game. It wasn't actually a blowout game. It was a rival game, and they had won it. And she's the oldest of four kids in a family that struggled. And she came out of the locker room, and her dad said, "Oh, honey, great game. So proud of you." And she looked at him and said, "Dad, I want the keys to the car. I'm going to Amanda's house." And I just thought, man, that's not right. Those people sacrificed a lot, and to just not engage with their family. And I just believe that that's how she would treat the coaches and her teammates. And she had a little bit of too much diva in them, is what I called it, a little bit too much diva for us. And we passed on her, and I'm glad we did.
She wasn't a Spartan.
She was not a Spartan.
She was. The Big Ten tournament and the dance are on the horizon. We should talk about that. What will your team be thinking about as you prepare?
Well, we have two more left in the regular season. We fly out tonight and we play tomorrow at Purdue on the Big Ten Network. And then we play at home on Sunday on senior night. And, you know, really it's been it's just like the men's side. And I know there's maybe not as many women's basketball fans out there, but it's very hard to win on the road. It's a very deep conference. Anybody can beat anybody any given night. So we have challenges ahead of us, that's for sure. We want to finish strong here and, you know, have a good showing in the Big Ten tournament. For us, we really want to position ourselves for a good seed in the NCAA tournament.
I love coming to women's games. It has a much more of a family feel. You can actually hear what's going on the court.
Yeah, you know, it's a different. I think people appreciate it because it's played below the rim for sure. And I think people have a more of a connection to the way the game used to be played back in the 70s, I should say, maybe even before that. So, you know, the fundamentals, the skill, the strategy, I think is a little more significant than the high-flying athleticism and size of the guys' game.
Susie Merchant, one of my all-time favorite people, thank you for joining us on Current State.
Appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
Years ago, 200 members of the American Indian Movement took over the town of Wounded Knee, South Dakota. The group was protesting the federal government's failure to honor the various treaties with the Native tribes. The location was symbolic. In 1890, as many as 300 Lakota Indians were killed at Wounded Knee by the U.S. Army. The 1973 standoff lasted 173 days and claimed three lives. A new book from Michigan State University Press recounts that incident and other moments in the history of the American relationship with its indigenous people. Winona LaDuke is the author of The Militarization of Indian Country. She's a member of the Anishinaabe Nation, and she spoke with Current State's Kevin Lavery.
actually, the American military power has a lot of dominance on a world scale. So we're not unique in this situation, considering it's the largest military in the world, dwarfing everybody by about 7 times. But the reality is that, you know, historically, Native people, American Indian people, were classified in the Department of War. We moved to Department of Interior in the last century, but just prior to that, we were over there in Department of War. And having said that, we ended up in a situation where there's a lot of military bases near Indian reservations, largely to, you know, from the Indian Wars. And over time, some of those bases disappeared and just became cities and towns, but a number of them continued and became full-scale military installations. And so to the extent that the United States military is a large landowner with a huge impact on the ecology and social and economics of a region, there is a significant impact on the Native community.
Our military is laden with references to Native Americans. We have Tomahawk missiles, Black Hawk helicopters, Apache helicopters. But it would seem that these names are not an attempt to honor Native people, but do they instead perpetuate a negative stereotype, a warrior mentality that perhaps is not true?
Well, they do in many ways, but you know, perhaps the most interesting and most recent case is that of when Osama bin Laden was assassinated by the U.S. military. The operation was called Operation Geronimo Enemy Killed in Action, EKIA, which was very much opposed by the Native community when, you know, people found out that, you know, someone who is revered in the Native community, Geronimo, is what they use in this last, you know, a couple of years ago as the name for Osama bin Laden as a code name in the military. It's not an honor. It's not an honor at all. You know, what I find to be kind of interesting is that in the military vernacular, like off the reservation means that you're leaving the base. You're going off the reservation into Indian territory. I mean, some of the vernacular still remains. So if commanders are still bringing up Indian war, you know, mythology in this day and age in a very, very powerful military, one would find that to be of some concern. And particularly, you know, what I will tell you, which is, I think if you read the book, you do know, is that Native people in the United States have the highest rate of enlistment in the military of any population. And we are overrepresented in the military, and we also have the highest rate of living veterans. And because of that, you know, the U.S. military's impact in Indian country is very significant, but also I feel like there's a measure of respect that is due to Native people, and that is not reflected when someone, you know, uses terminology that kind of remanufactures the Indian Wars in this new millennium.
The publication of your book really is very timely. I don't know if you're following what's happening here in Michigan, but the state of Michigan recently has filed a complaint against the U.S. Department of Education's Civil Rights Office to put an end to the use of American Indian names, mascots, different types of imagery in our school districts. And the argument that the state makes is that using these names and images creates what they call an unequal learning environment that violates federal civil rights law. Have you found that to be true?
Oh, that's really interesting. I did not know the state of Michigan has done that. I applaud the state of Michigan for that action. A lot of studies have been done on the impact of mascots on Native students, and they're not positive. You know, it's not a positive set of imagery. There's this set of associations that kind of sticks Native people in a certain place and in a certain caricature. I mean, if people care about American history or present civics, you don't learn about Native people through calling them Redskins or calling them the Fighting Sioux out of North Dakota. We are a part of all classes that are at the university, and it is really important that we're not characterized and, you know, stuck in some place. So I'm really proud the state of Michigan has taken that.
One of the reasons I had wanted to talk with you, Winona, is that February 27th is the 40th anniversary of the start of the American Indian Movement occupation at Wounded Knee, South Dakota, which, of course, was very symbolic of the huge massacre there in 1890. Any thoughts on the coincidence of the publication of your book and the 40th anniversary, and also the fact that just about 4 months ago, the activist and actor Russell Means passed away?
Now, thank you for bringing that up. You know, in 1973, Lakota elders and families occupied the land at Wounded Knee on the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota for 71 days to protest the corruption that had occurred.
The militant American Indian movement called this meeting to seek the support of the tribal elders of the Pine Ridge Reservation for a bold plan to force federal attention to Indian demands. Not all of the hereditary chiefs attended, and among those who did, it was clear there was not total support for the militants.
they were faced with a huge arsenal of the U.S. military, huge numbers of armored personnel carriers, and a full onslaught that, you know, lasted for 71 days against, you know, people that were very few in numbers.
The Oglala Nation is at a crossroads that can change the course of history for Indian people all across the nation. And sometimes there has to be violence to force the white man to listen. You leaders, you chiefs, have to be right there with us when we do it. But we seize wounded knee. Either we force the federal government to kill us all once again like they did 83 years ago at Wounded Knee, or else they come out and they negotiate and meet our demands.
The Wounded Knee takeover took place, you know, at the location of the Wounded Knee Massacre of December 29th, 1890. And there the U.S. cavalry surrounded and just slaughtered about 300 unarmed men, women, and children, Lakota people. And, you know, ironically, there were 43 Congressional Medals of Honor that were awarded to the soldiers who participated in that. You know, I find that problematic. And we're asking for a lot of those to be, you know, withdrawn at this point. But you shouldn't get Medals of Honor for killing Indians.
In your book, you mention Ira Hayes. He was a corporal in the Marine Corps in World War II, fought at Iwo Jima. In fact, he was one of the six men in that famous photograph of the flag raising on Mount Suribachi on Iwo Jima. Ira Hayes was a member of the Pima tribe in Arizona, and as the war was ending, he was taken out of combat and put into a war bond campaign that you could argue exploited him. He suffered from post-traumatic stress disorder and became an alcoholic, and he died at age 32, about 10 years after the war ended. It's interesting that when you look at the photograph, he is the one on the far left-hand side, the one who just can't quite reach the flagpole. He can almost touch the flag, but can't. Do you see a metaphor there?
I do. I hadn't really thought of it that way, but it's true. We're at the front lines in the military, and yet when we come home, things are not so good. And they went away, you know, hoping that they could get a little bit more for their families because they're coming out of dire poverty, many of these communities. And what they had hoped was when they came back, they would be in a better situation. And indeed, some are. There's no question about it. But a good portion of those who serve in the military and a good portion certainly of those who serve in the military in Indian country, at the time I wrote this, and to a certain extent now, came back and they were treated as second-class citizens indeed. And so it is an ironic story.
Winona LaDuc is a member of the Anishinaabe Nation and the author of The Militarization of Indian Country, which is now available through the Michigan State University Press. Ms. LaDuc, it's really been a pleasure talking with you, and thank you for your time today.
Miigwech, thanks for calling.
For Current State, I'm Kevin Lavery.
Coming up after the break, Scott Pohl's conversation with opera star Renee Fleming, who has graced the most storied stages in the opera genre, but tonight will be her first appearance at MSU's Wharton Center. We'll talk with this week's Neighbors in Action, a fascinating group that supports Lansing firefighters, and meet the Lansing judge who wrote a book about one of Michigan's most notorious unsolved crimes. With Joel Lindstroff, I'm Scott Westerman for Mark Bayshore, and you're listening to Current State on WKAR.
Support for WKAR is provided by City Pulse. This week's issue features a look at the new genre of comics, available in 470 locations around Lansing and at LansingCityPulse.com. And by MSU Federal Credit Union, providing credit union members with 24-hour account access online and now on your mobile internet. Insured by NCUA.
Program is Current State on WKAR. I'm Scott Westerman from Mark Bayshore. Before the assassination of State Senator Warren Hooper in 1945, corruption in Michigan politics was the norm and not the exception. While it remains unsolved, the Hooper hit, which was widely believed to be the work of Detroit's infamous Purple Gang, ushered in a crackdown on corruption and altered the political climate in Lansing for good. Michigan Court of Appeals Judge Bill Whitbeck is the author of To Account for Murder, which is based on the Hooper mystery. Judge Whitbeck joins us on Current State. Welcome.
Good morning.
Sounds like an amazing story. Who was Warren Hooper, then the Purple Gang, and what was the story?
Well, Warren Hooper was a recently elected state senator in January of 1945. He had just taken the oath as a state senator, but he had been a state rep for a number of years. And he was not a terribly interesting man, frankly, kind of a nondescript face, sort of, how shall I put it, had a hairline about like mine, which was not much.
Handsome guy.
Handsome guy, yeah. But he did have one distinguishing, or at least sort of distinguishing feature. He was a crook. By that I mean he had for years been taking bribes as a state representative, and he was perfectly prepared to continue to do that as a state senator. But there was an intervening event, and that was the appointment of a one-man grand jury in Lansing to investigate corruption at the state capitol. Michigan is unique in the 50 states as having a statute that allows a one-man grand jury. The one man was Circuit Court Judge Leland Carr. He appointed as his special prosecutor, shades of Watergate, probably the foremost trial lawyer in Michigan, Kim Siegler. And Siegler and Carr had received information through a variety of sources that Warren Hooper was on the take. And they had called him before the grand jury in secret, and he had testified in secret. Now, we don't know what he said because those transcripts are still sealed. They may not even exist anymore.
Sounds like immunity is coming up here.
They did grant him immunity, probably, although that was never clear. But he was about to testify in open court. And the man he was about to name, almost certainly, was one Frank McKay, who was, I think it's fair to say, the boss of the Republican Party in Michigan from Grand Rapids, indicted 13 times, never convicted. And probably what happened was McKay and others got wind of the fact that Hooper was going to testify, was going to implicate them. And that's all fact. Now I'm going to speculate. The speculation is that perhaps Frank McKay went over to Jackson State Penitentiary, bribed the warden, who happened to be named Jackson, coincidentally, for $10,000, and then bribed three members of Detroit's infamous Purple Gang.
The ones from the Elvis song.
They're the ones. The Purple Gang were the only really large-scale Jewish mob in the country. There's been a lot of Jewish gangsters, but this was the only organized large-scale Jewish mob in the country, and they were deadly, I think is the only way of putting it. Grew up in the streets of Detroit, either immigrants or the sons of immigrants. 500 murders to their credit during, if you want to use that term.
And you think Hooper was one of them. How did the hit take place?
Well, I think what happened, speculation again, is that the warden gave the three members of the Purple Gang, including Ray Bernstein, the head of the Purple Gang, really, there were a lot of Bernstein brothers involved, gave them his car.
A get-out-of-jail-free card for the night?
Exactly. They had his car. They were on the count in the morning. They took the car. They waylaid the senator as he was on his way back to Albion, where he was from, forced his car off the road, shot him once through the back rear window in the head, and then approached on the driver's side and shot him two more times, left the car body in the car. It happened that Hooper was a smoker. His cigarette caused some upholstery to char, but so there was a fire in the car, and he was partially burned. But that wasn't what killed him. Three bullets in his brain was what killed him.
Is this where your book starts after the crime takes place?
The book does start after the crime takes place, and I have invented most of the characters are invented. Some of them are patterned a little bit after the real people, but allegedly the Purple Gang members then drove the warden's car back to Jackson. They were on the count in the evening. They had an ironclad alibi. They couldn't have committed the murder. They were in jail at the time. And no one, in fact, has ever been convicted of the crime. Some of the minor Purple Net gang members were convicted of conspiracy, but no one has actually been convicted of the crime of murdering State Senator Warren P. Hooper, and the crime is still open at the state police.
This must have made a lot of people very angry.
It did. What it did was turn sort of a local, perhaps state issue into a national issue. The crime, Siegler and Carr were known within the state that they were investigating corruption in the Capitol, but all of a sudden the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal were writing up Leland Carr and Kim Siegler. And the crime focused enormous attention on the situation in Michigan, which was, unlike the way it is currently, in my opinion, very, very corrupt. At one point, Siegler had one-third of the Michigan legislature under indictment. That's a lot of votes. But
wow.
With the killing of Hooper, with Siegler's subsequent convictions of a number of other figures involved, but never of anyone on the murder, with Siegler's later election as governor in 1946, followed by Soapy Williams, who beat him in 1948.
Why write the book?
Well, I always thought I wanted to write a book. I went to Northwestern as a journalism major. My degree, undergraduate degree, is in journalism. I did not, except for a couple summers at the Chicago Tribune. I became a lawyer, not a journalist. But I always thought I could write a book. I didn't realize that almost everyone thinks they can write a book.
How long did it take you to do it?
Well, that's a question I answer in two fashions. It took me 20 years if you start from beginning to end. But there were a lot of things interrupted for 4 or 5 years along the way.
Life gets in the way.
Life got in the way. Going back to law practice got in the way. Becoming a judge got in the way. I finally finished it. I would say of the time working on it, probably nights and weekends, 3 or 4 years.
And 2010 was when the book came out.
Yes, came out in 2010. It's still in print, still available through Amazon and through the local bookstores. You can order it. I don't know that they have it in stock, but you can order it.
A fascinating story, and I can't wait to read it. Allison Liotta, Megan Abbott, and now you are one of the people that I want to put on my reading list. The book is Account for Murder, authored by our guest, Judge Bill Whitbeck. Thanks for joining us.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Concerts, Grammys, performing all over the world, opera star Renee Fleming has done it all, except perform in East Lansing. Tonight, The Soprano can check that off her list as well. Renee Fleming spoke with WKAR's Scott Pohl about her latest album, singing for Queen Elizabeth II, and the program she has planned for MSU's Wharton Center for Performing Arts this evening.
I decided that I wanted to, because it's my first time there, I wanted to really make a fun program with a tremendous amount of variety in it, sort of indicating a broad array of interests that I've had, musically speaking. I love song recitals. I love poetry. And in classical music, of course, we have the pleasure of being able to perform 300 years of music. So I'm starting in the Baroque, actually, in the 17th century with Handel arias, and all in English. And then I am singing three Strauss songs. Richard Strauss is my Desert Island composer. A couple of arias from André Previn's A Streetcar Named Desire. Then after intermission, French songs. Debussy, it's his 150th birthday this year. And Canteloube songs, which are hugely popular settings of mountain songs from the region in France called the Auvergne. And I'm ending the program with Italian arias that everybody loves, popular Italian arias. So I think it's going to be fun for all of us, for me too, I hope.
Now, I understand that this performance is part of a limited number of recitals like this that you're doing this year. How do these recitals fit in with the rest of your obligations, and what are those obligations?
That's a great question. You know, I do a huge variety of things now because, of course, opera is part of my calendar. Orchestral concerts, whether of, you know, gala nature or of a whole weekend of three or four concerts. I have, I love recitals, as I said. I sing all over the world. So after this, I go to Asia for a tour through China and Taiwan and Hong Kong. Very interesting tour. I'm also Lyric Opera of Chicago's creative consultant. So that's been a really fascinating expansion of my duties. And I'm enjoying really thinking about, you know, all kinds of things that relate to arts advocacy and presenting and audience development. It's been fascinating.
Tell me about the accompaniment for a program like this. Who's playing with you?
This is Richard Beto, who's a very longtime friend and colleague. He is Houston Grand Opera's chorus master and also the head of the opera department at Rice University. And we've known each other since we were about 17 years old. We met at a summer festival, the Chautauqua Festival, and we've been colleagues and ever since. So he brings a great deal of flair to and experience, and we have a wonderful time together when we can find time to actually work together. So this is piano. The piano recital is a long-held tradition of that comes really from people singing in the parlor in people's homes. It wasn't that long ago that there was no recorded anything, no film, no television, no radio. And so all of the music that was heard was produced live by people, and a lot of it was made at home.
I wanted to ask you about winning another Grammy. You just won your fourth Grammy Award for Best Classical Vocal Solo. Tell me about your most recent recording.
It's called Poem, and it consists of three major orchestral pieces for soprano, all French. The most famous and best known would be Ravel's Scheherazade. Henri Dutilleux, who is probably France's best-loved and known 20th century composer, was a collaborator with me on the songs that he wrote, Le Temps L'Horloge. And the third piece, the Messiaen's Poème pour Me, which was a cycle that he wrote for his wife probably 60 years ago. So this is a really serious album, and to have it receive this kind of validation is a tremendous gift.
Does winning Grammy Awards ever get old?
No, winning a Grammy never gets old. In fact, I will never forget meeting Sir George Schulte and walking into his studio for the first rehearsal and seeing 30 of them lined up on his windowsill. So that's pretty unusual. Leontine Price, when I met her also, I think she had 13 or 14 of them. And I'm sure they treasure them just as much as I do. It's an incredible honor. It's the greatest, it's the highest honor we have in the U.S. for a recorded legacy, which requires years and years of effort.
You have some catching up to do then.
Yes, well, I think that's highly unlikely. Yeah, that was an extraordinary time.
One of the landmark events in your career in the last couple of years has to have been performing on the balcony of Buckingham Palace to celebrate the Queen's Jubilee last year.
That was amazing. I mean, just to be in the palace is extraordinary. And to be able to go out on the balcony, which I believe historically has only happened to members of the royal family, was such a thrill. The whole event, I mean, to be able to perform in events like that, you can't underestimate the excitement. of the group mentality of all the performers who are backstage. And that's half the fun, is really meeting all of these iconic and legendary performers as well.
People who would like to learn more about you, I want to direct to an extraordinary interview you did last year with Alec Baldwin on his WNYC program called Here's the Thing.
Oh, you heard that?
Yes.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, he's a terrific interviewer, and it's very in-depth, and he's so musically curious himself, he asks a lot of interesting questions.
You said to him that you hate talking on the telephone, so I want to thank you for indulging me in talking with me on the telephone.
Oh, that's very kind. It's true. I try to protect my voice, and talking on the phone actually is a very fatiguing, vocally fatiguing thing.
With Renee Fleming, I'm Scott Pohl for Current State.
Each Wednesday on our Neighbors in Action segment, we feature a person or organization that is working to make our community a better place. This year celebrates the 75th anniversary of Lansing's Box 23, an all-volunteer organization that provides refreshments and support for our firefighters as they battle the worst fires. Longtime volunteer Dave Rule joins us along with Lansing firefighter Steve Babcock. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you.
What is Box 23, Dave, and how did it come to be?
Well, Box 23 goes back to the 1934, where the Hotel Kearns, which we used to be at the corner of Grand and Michigan, burned. It was Lansing's most serious fire. And from that point, Box 23 involved some 3 years later to the day. In fact, Steve can give a pretty good historical account of that because he's
What
pretty
started it? What started it was in the 30s, telephones, much less cell phones, were not very prevalent in homes. And throughout the city were fire alarm boxes on each corner. And each box had a number. And people who were in trouble, they needed the fire department to come, would go, pull the handle. It would set off an alarm by a number, such as 23. It'd ring twice a space, and then three times. And it would say, well, that box is at the corner of Grand and Ottawa, and it requires these pieces of apparatus to go.
The Kern Hotel.
The Kern's Hotel.
It was wood, right?
It was a four-story wood structure, the premier hotel of its time in the city. It offered, each room had piped in ice water, a big deal. Now, on December the 11th of 1934, a special session in the state legislature brought even more people to the city. They were trying to work out problems with the state budget. So 5:30 in the morning, this box gets pulled by the night janitor from the Lansing State Journals, whose offices was at the dead end of Ottawa at the river.
So he gave up the scoop to save some lives.
Exactly. He looked out the window and saw the flicker of flame. By the time he got to the box, he had two floors of the four floors well involved. He pulls the box. The fellas from Station 1 and Station 3 at Grand and Allegan, just down the street, get on scene and say, holy moly, we need some assistance. And they transmitted another alarm off this same box as a telegraph system that brought every other available on-duty fireman and apparatus to the scene. As they were battling this fire, they realized, well, we're outmatched. They actually called for help from full-time fire departments from as far away as Owosso, Jackson, Battle Creek, and Grand Rapids.
And that took a long time
to get here. Word spread of this big fire in this hotel throughout the city. As the word spread, people came to watch. Well, the movers and the shakers of the time, the businessmen, looked and said, boy, those guys are really, they need some help. They opened their shops and brought dry gloves, dry socks, coffee, something to assist the firemen. 14 Lansing firefighters were injured during the fire. One fella, an engineer, was actually struck by someone who fell out of the hotel, and he was later taken to the hospital with what the State Journal called a broken back. 34 people lost their lives, 7 of more of those state legislators. So there's a big ownership into this that the community has. Now, 3 years later, to the day, like Dave already said, that same group, core group of people, said, we've got to organize and make this an official group. And for the next 75 years, from 1937 right through today, their dedication and their mission is to assist Lansing Fire Department whenever called. regardless of the time of the day or night.
So, Dave, how do you do that?
Very simply, we've got support from one of the answering services, and the mechanism as such would be that the battalion chief or whoever is on the scene determines if they want Box 23. They then notify dispatch. Dispatch notifies our answering service, and the answering service in turn notifies us. We also have a backup system with a phone tree. Usually the phones are going off, get there, get there, get there. So we rely on the answering service, which they've done some pro bono for us. And, of course, we hope dispatch remembers us.
And what happens when you get there? What kind of support do you provide?
What we'll do is, I can remember back the old days, we'd go down to the fire department, we'd boil the water, dump some coffee in it, and off we'd go. Today, we're a little more sophisticated. We have air pots, pressure pots. We make a fresh pot of coffee at home, put it in there. We also take some water with us, bottled water. So we get there. The guys need water when they come out of that fire. We then also might stop and pick up something, donuts or rolls or whatever it might be. If we find this, we're going to be there for quite a while, we then go into another contingency plan where we'll talk with some of the retailers in town or some of the merchants, fast food places that donate some items to us. We support them in whatever way we can. Dry gloves, socks, moral support, water, food, just being there, helping them out, whatever it might be.
Dave, how many fires are there in Lansing every year? I mean, Steve.
Well, I don't have the exact numbers for last year, but to give you an idea, we did citywide, department-wide, with everything we do, we did over 18,100 alarms last year. Now, the majority of those are EMS, Emergency Medical Services, about 80, 82%. But that being said, we also did every specialty that we do as a full-service career fire department, meaning pin-ins, extrications, auto accidents, technical rescue. We did high angle, we did structural collapse, we did trench rescue last year, we did hazardous materials responses last year. So everything we do, heavy rescue, like I said, automobile accidents, of course, structure fires.
Mm-hmm. What's the most common cause of a structure fire? Is there one thing?
I don't know what the actual national standards are. Mm-hmm. A lot of them at night, the most deadly at night is improper leaving food cooking on the stove.
Mm, okay.
Okay. Mm-hmm. That and the biggie, unfortunately, for loss of life is not having working smoke detectors. Mm. And it's imperative that they work.
Dave Rule, Box 23 for many years has been a pretty secretive organization until 77 when Jerry Graves brought you above the radar.
Good old Jerry. Yep.
And now you're looking for volunteers. How can people get involved?
They can just simply give us a call. We'd be more than happy to talk with them. The interesting part is that Box 23 has a friendly agreement or our bylaws, and that states that there shall be more than 23 members in the club at one time. Well, I wish we had that problem today, to be very truthful with you. Our volunteerism isn't what it used to be. Our membership is down a little bit as far as active members, and we want to be able to serve the department in whatever capacity we can. We want some more members.
How do you recruit younger people to do this?
We just simply tell them, you got to get out of bed at 2 o'clock in the morning, 20 degrees below zero, and do your thing for the city.
Sounds wonderful.
And it is wonderful. The one of the bywords that the fire service has embraced over the last 20 years is rehabilitation at a scene, and the importance of you're working off your second bottle, you come out, you've got to take a break, okay? Well, Box 23 has been assisting us in this rehab for 75 years, and now the fire service is just now figuring out. Other communities have similar organizations. Chicago has a 511 club. They didn't come into play until 1957, 20 years later than what Lansing did. Detroit has a club. They didn't come into play until the mid-40s. So once again,
Lansing, Michigan
truly does lead the way.
Dave Rule is a longtime Box 23 member, and Steve Babcock is a Lansing firefighter. Thank you both for discussing Box 23's work within the Lansing community.
We appreciate that.
Support for WKAR is provided by Wharton Center, presenting soprano Renee Fleming February 27th. Associated with the Met Opera, heard on Prairie Home Companion and live from Lincoln Center, Renee Fleming performs a night of song. WhartonCenter.com.
and by Liberty Coin Service, now open with a new location in Frandor, offering gold buying and coin collecting services in one combined location for more than 40 years. LibertyCoinService.com.